prove with you today, and hopefully I'll keep you interested enough that while you're standing there and you're getting soaked, you won't mind it so much. Do you want to make sure you got everybody?
Yeah, I want to thank
you. While I pass out the maps, I was told I had about 43 this morning, so I have slightly more than 43 here. Why don't you go ahead and call the names and we'll see if you got everybody.
William Beck.
Start.
Yeah, again, I'm Eric Campbell. I'm a park ranger here at Gettysburg Battlefield. I've been here about 10 years altogether, and I present a variety of programs on all 3 days of the battle and the aftermath. And what you'll mostly learn about if you go on any one of my programs or any other ranger's programs here at Gettysburg is you'll mostly learn about the battle. And that'll make sense. That's why the park's here. The events that took place here on July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of 1863 were momentous. It changed the tide of history and helped determine our history as a nation. But one thing that we tend to forget sometimes is that in the 133 years since the battle, a lot else has happened on this park. And what I want to do today is a little bit of both. I want to talk about one particular, not phase of the battle, one particular area of the battlefield. That's Cemetery Hill. It's certainly one of the most famous, although in today's times, it does sometimes get overlooked, the significance of the hill itself and what happened on its slopes. But a lot of other events happened on Cemetery Hill. And if you begin to look at what happened on Cemetery Hill from the battle until today, you begin to see a layer of history. A lot of other things have happened on that hill which define the battlefield as we know it today. And that's what I want to talk about. Not only Cemetery Hill during the battle itself, but what else happened since that has defined this park as we know it and what it means to us today. Okay.
Let's just see if we have any late arrivals.
Start.
The cannon on the top of the hill, are they're the same cannon we used, the replacement cannon?
Most of the cannon barrels on the battlefield are original to the Civil War, but not necessarily Gettysburg. As a matter of fact, if you look at the front of the tube, the muzzle, you'll notice stampings and markings. I can't get you on. I appreciate that. I'll just read the one.
Okay.
Okay. We can't prove which ones were here and which ones weren't, but for some of the stampings and markings, some of the stampings and markings 1864 or 1865, so obviously they weren't here at the time of the battle. The only ones we can really prove were the ones out by Buford statue, west of town, by the base of his monument, because the commander in that battery wrote down the serial numbers of them. Once you did the battle, commander couldn't do that.
So then you really did move those in there.
Yeah, the War Department brought most of the cannons back. Once they were obsolete, the Army didn't need them anymore. They began to melt them down or bury them. And then they began to get a good idea of bringing them back to the battlefield.
I guess another question is your opinion on whether the first day.
Yeah, that's something I didn't talk too much about. One of you all kept attacking on the first day instead of halting. I think it's not only, my personal opinion is, without getting too lengthy here, it's not only Ewell's hesitancy to attack, it's also Lee's fault, because Lee's the one that gave Ewell the order, attack those hills if you think it's practicable, but avoid a general engagement. And how the heck can you make an attack without bringing on a battle? It's hard to do one without the other. And besides, Ewell's got these reports of troops for his rear, the Union Army's really rallying rapidly up here. His men have been exhausted by marching and fighting all day on July 1st, and they captured so many prisoners in town that it really slowed them down. One man, General Rhodes is the one who's supposed to attack the other side of the hill, remember him. He said in his official report, my movements were embarrassed materially by capturing so many prisoners. So all of that combined to really decide in Ewell's mind not to attack. And I'm wondering, even if he had, whether it would have taken the hill anyway. So I don't quite blame him. The most famous question in association with that is, what if Jack could have been here? Of course, it's something we'll never know. Okay. Now, as I said, there's a heavy responsibility resting on the soldiers. Resting on the soldiers who have to defend this area. Now, we know why Cemetery Hill is so important. Who has to hold it? Well, I mentioned earlier there are two brigades of battered 11th Corps men, numbering about 1,200 officers and men who defend this part of the hill, East Cemetery Hill, as it's known. They line up right along this lane, which is here in 1863. These 11th Corps soldiers had a very rough experience all of 1863. Many of you probably know that many of the men in the 11th Corps are recent immigrants from Germany, fighting for the new country to prove they were good citizens. So already there's a mark against it. They're foreigners. Then at Chancellorsville, the battle fought before Gettysburg, they get whipped by the Confederates. Placed in a bad position, outflanked, attacked from the rear, they quite naturally fled the battlefield. I would too. So everybody blamed the 11th Corps for the great defeat at Chancellorsville. on July 1st, north of town. Again, they fought well for a while, but again, placed in a bad position. They were attacked from the rear, from the right, from the flank, and they routed once again. So everybody blamed them again on July 1st for losing the battle. At least the first day. By the time they get down here, in the evening of July 1st, into the day, the morning and afternoon of July 2nd, the morale is very low, they're demoralized, their confidence is shaking, their discipline is lacking. If these men have to defend this area and hold this hill, again, 1,200 men altogether. Eventually attacking them, as we'll soon see, will be two brigades of General Early's division, totaling about 2,550 men from North Carolina and Louisiana. Now the map I gave you, if you want to pull it out, shows you... Well, I'm trying to memorize it. There are two brigades. These two brigades are under the command of a man named General Harry Hayes and Colonel Avery. They are not facing this hill directly, but lined up on the northern streets of town, kind of where the junior high is today, just beyond that. Facing... They're lined up this way. So they're facing this way. Okay, and they're the ones who are going to attack this hill that afternoon. Now, by the time the Culp's Hill comes under attack, the men of Early's division, these two brigades, are going to make this attack. These Louisiana, North Carolina troops obviously began to realize what was happening. The tension began to mount in their ranks. They knew they would soon advance. One of the Confederates recalled, "I felt as my doom was sealed. It was with great reluctance I started my men forward." They had laid out there for 14 hours that day in the heat and humidity, and they had seen how the Union Army had fortified this hill and reinforced it. They're trying to make an attack up this steep slope. Try to imagine looking at that for 14 hours, and now suddenly, in order to attack us, it seemed like suicide to them. Yet they're going to make the attack anyway. When the order was finally given to advance, the Confederate line moved forward despite the odds against them, one man said, with a firm determination to do or die. Now, in order to attack this hill, it's obvious they can't just move straight ahead. For if they do, they'll come out of the cover of this swale, this low ground they're lying in, and move right towards Culp's Hill. So in order to attack this hill, map 2 shows you this, by the way, and they'll step up, move over the ridge, and make a wheeling movement. A right wheel, and these are all open fields in 1863, all open. This wood line over here did not exist. You clearly would have seen them coming, make a wheel to attack this hill head on in this direction. That's what they have to do. I'm sorry, what? Yes, it was rolling like, just like you see here. But except for the trees, it's pretty much the same. Okay, so right around 7:45, then the attack is beginning. The sun is set, dusk is deepening, and now suddenly the first Union troops see this approaching Confederate line. It's not the troops here, it's a battery artillery, the 5th Maine Battery, on the little knoll that sits between Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill, today called Stevens Knoll. And they immediately opened fire. Shells began to burst along the Confederate line. Well, that then alerted the batteries up on the hill behind you as to what was coming. And the commander of the 5th Maine Battery, Lieutenant Edward Whittier, described these guns opening fire upon the approaching Confederate line. This is what he wrote. He said he recalled how this fire made the ground tremble with their volleys, plowing through their lines. The enemy, now, let me try this again. They made the ground tremble with their volleys, plowing through the lines of the enemy, now in full movement and charging upon their position. Henry Hayes, commanding the Louisiana Brigade that's attacking this area, said, "I had gone but a short distance when my whole line became exposed to a terrific fire of the enemy's batteries from the entire range of hills in front and to the right." Yet, despite the fire, the advance continued, and the determination of the average Confederate soldier right towards this hill. That's good. They can attack their enemy head on. The problem is, by moving in this direction now, they expose their left flank to the fire of the battery on Stevens Knoll, the 5th Maine Battery. That battery began to rake the entire length of the line. Solid shots flying down the line. Canister, big shotgun-like blast, just hitting him. Lieutenant Whittier, commanding that battery, described this. The whole battery with double canister pouring the most destructive, flanking, demoralizing fire into the confused mass of the enemy struggling in the uncertain shadows at the base of the hill. Scene of wildest confusion, as you can imagine. The Confederates struggled onward. A Union infantry soldier in the base of the hill recalled this. This is what he wrote. "The darkness has lighted up the flames of the cannons' mouths and seen to pour down in streams upon them. The roar and shriek of shot and shell plowed through their ranks, is appalling. The gaps, though bravely closed up and still they advance, nothing could seem to check them." Now, adding to the hellish confusion for the Confederates, I think, was the musketry fire was soon opened along this line. So now they get musketry and artillery. A Massachusetts soldier wrote, "They near 50 yards were rapid and awful fire poured into them until there were almost as many upon the ground as in their lines. Somehow the Confederates rallied and kept right on moving, right through this. Now, they faced many disadvantages, as I talked about. The overwhelming fire, the openness of the ground they had to cross, the wheeling movement, but now suddenly they had a lot of advantages. They would temporarily work in their favor. One of the advantages was the extra steepness of this hill. Now, you think charging up it can be very difficult, and it is. But the closer and closer you get to this hill, what it basically means is the less and less fire you get from this artillery up here. Until finally, you're actually under the enemy artillery. You've actually gotten under their muzzles. They can't depress the barrels down the hill to fire down this steep slope. So the fire began to lessen right before they got to the Union line. And the second advantage that worked for them temporarily was the darkness. It seemed to save them for a moment. Although it added to the confusion, General Hayes, commanding that Louisiana brigade, later remembered, owing to the darkness of the evening, now verging into night, the deep obscurity afforded by the smoke of the firing, our exact locality could not be discovered by the enemy's gunners. Thus, their escape when in full light of day would have been nothing less than a horrible slaughter. This darkness also combined with the very thick smoke of the gunpowder and the growing fire, as you can imagine, unnerved these shaky 11th Corps men down at the base of this hill. And suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, loomed the Confederate line. Especially right here. If you look out, you see how this knoll rises up just a short distance in front of the Union line. Suddenly, out of that smoke and confusion, loomed up the Confederate battle line. It was also very bad down to your left. Colonel Andrew Harris, commanding a Union brigade that stretched up the hill facing the town, recalled this. This attack, he said, was a complete surprise to us. We did not expect this assault as bravely and rapidly made. In fact, we did not expect any assault. We would not have been much more surprised if the moving column had rised up out of the ground amid the waving timothy grass in the meadow. And then right after that, the Confederate line struck hard. Colonel Harris recalling the fighting which broke out. Along my whole line, he said, the fighting was obstinate and bloody. The bayonet, club, musket, anything in fact that could be made available was used. And then suddenly, the Confederates surged through a critical gap in the Union line that had been created by the shifting of some men. That gap was farther down to your left. The Confederates went right through that gap. And as soon as they did, the Union line was doomed. Not only is the Union line a little bit shaky, but now troops coming in on their left and on their right exposed the flanks of the Union battle line and the Confederates poured right through the gap, and the Union line simply disintegrated. Pockets of resistance would actually stay at the base of this hill and fight on, and large sections of the Union line just broke in confusion, and the men began running right up the hill, right towards their cannons, trying to get away. General Hayes' Louisiana Tigers, as they were called, were a maddened column, one man said, a maddened column that rushed up the hill with heroic determination. These Confederates, both Louisiana soldiers, North Carolina soldiers, sent victory at the top of that hill. They could reach the top of the hill, capture those batteries, they might just win the battle and end the war. Let's follow their footsteps, see how close they came. Okay?
Go back to the hill.
That's a good question. Okay, any questions before
I didn't pick up your comment on the vegetation there. You say it was high wheat?
It was a pasture probably, just like it is today. Maybe oats. I'm not sure exactly what kind of crop it is.
Like it is today,
pretty much as it is. Okay. And the topography is the same, rolling. But the big woodlot here did not exist, and none of these big trees did either. And the tree line on Culpeper was farther back. So all that was much more open.
Was there more fences? Your map showed quite a few fences.
Yeah, there would have been more. And these stone walls were here at the time, running up the slope. But there would have been more fences out there, too, where the Confederates were coming from. Yeah, absolutely.
So they'd be crossing fences on the slope.
Right. Absolutely.
Did the Delta Corps build anything down there?
Not that I know of. They might have piled the fence rails on top of the stone wall and tried to make it a little bit higher, but from what I could tell, they didn't really dig in that much. Fortifying at that time, the Civil War wasn't as common as it would later become. So it was an exception rather than the rule to see men, dig in. So that's why they probably didn't dig in. Okay, they probably thought the position was just as strong as Confederates did, so they saw no reason to dig in. Now, these men dug in up here, obviously, though. Okay, now, with the collapse of the Union battle line down at the base of the hills we just described, and many of the 11th Corps men running up the hill trying to get away, obviously exposed all the batteries on top of this hill, like the battery right behind you. Pennsylvania Battery, F&G, 1st Pennsylvania, commanded by Captain Bruce Ricketts. Now, from trying to take this all in now from the perspective of a Union artilleryman, at this point, the situation's mass confusion. You've got tremendous noise and firing, a deepening darkness. The smoke is so thick, one man said, you cannot see more than 10 yards. Then suddenly through that smoke rushes your own infantry, right through your guns. Some of them seemingly at the verge of panic. So that's going to make you get a little bit more tense, I think. You're firing away, you have no idea what's coming ahead. Men start to rush through your guns, and now following them are the Confederates, right on their heels. The first battery that was actually hit by the Confederate assault was the battery on the other side of this one. It was those guns just on the other side of General Howard's monument. It's a New York battery commanded by Captain Michael Weidrick. The Confederates reached the guns and began to try to struggle to capture them. The Union artillerymen, though, stood fast. The New Yorkers, one man said, seized rammers, hand spikes, fence rails, threw shot with their hands, and the officers used their sabers and pistols with remarkable activity and energy to save their guns. While the struggle for that battery continued, the Confederates reached the next battery line, Ricketts Battery, right here. At least the left end of the battery, the first couple of guns. And they began to spread down the battery then. Another desperate struggle occurred, one man said, with hand spikes, rammers, stones, and pistols. Lieutenant C. Brockway of the battery probably best described this wild melee. This is what he later wrote. The scene was now one of wildest confusion. Friends and foes were indiscriminately mixed, and our brave men, though outnumbered and without arms, by means of hand spikes, rammers, stones, etc., made a sturdy resistance, animating each other with the shouts and cries to conquer on the soil of our native state or perish. Major James Buell was in the 21st North Carolina. He reached this battery, and this is what he wrote. The hour was one of horror. Amid the incessant roar of cannon, the din of musketry, and the glare of bursting shells, making the darkness intermittent, adding to the awfulness of the scene, the hoarse shouts of friend and foe, the piteous cries of wounded and the dying, one can well imagine that war is hell.
Oh man, oh man. Can't even turn the pages anymore. Yeah.
Okay, so they're struggling for the battery, and they capture these batteries. They think they have victory.
Yeah.
We're right on the verge here. The tension's mounting. I feel it. Ah, there we go. At this point, the Confederates actually had captured 1.5 batteries and parts of the crest of East Cemetery Hill, despite all the disadvantage they had gotten here. Imagine trying to swarm up that slope, but they had done it. Now, expected at any moment, remember, assistance from the other side of the hill. While Early's attacking here, General Rodes is supposed to attack the northwest side of the hill. But unknown to them, that attack would never occur. They had barely gotten started. Rodes' men had barely gotten on the streets of Gettysburg. But basically, Rodes decided the position he was to attack was too strong, it was too late, and he called the attack off. So he's moving back. And these men up here are struggling to get here, are thinking they're going to get help at any minute, but they have no idea. Well, at the same time, of course, the Union Army, the Union High Command, is reacting to this crisis. They had to throw the Confederates back down the slope, and reinforcements being launched or moved in this way to launch a counterattack. Second Corps men arrived, sent by General Hancock, rushing through the cemetery, right through the cemetery gate behind you. They rush up here. At the same time, 11th Corps men, led by General Howard, rushed right through where the National Cemetery is today, and they arrived right along the Baltimore Pike behind you. The Confederates up here in the gloom and darkness and smoke think those men might be their own men. So they hold their fire back, not wanting to kill their own men. Of course, those Union lines then open fire, catching the Confederates by surprise, launch a counterattack right through the guns, and in a very brief struggle, they throw the Confederates right back down the slope because of the miscommunication and confusion. The attack then was repulsed, and the key position to the Union line was secure. This had only been one of many close calls for the Union Army that day, however. They had also had many close calls at Culp's Hill and along the left end of the Union line, too. So though they could take satisfaction, I think, in holding this vital terrain feature, the Union soldiers along this hill certainly knew the battle was far from over. And they had no idea what would help for them tomorrow, or the next day, July 3rd. Lieutenant Whittier probably described these feelings best. He's the man that commands the battery right over here, the 5th Maine. The following night found the Potomac Army in a situation that demanded the most grave and serious consideration. We repulsed the last assault, but nearly 20,000 men had fallen in the desperate battle that day. Men took position in silence, for the exultation of victory was not to be felt to cause them to forget fatigue, hunger, suffering comrades, and the chance of death in the coming day. The twilight shattered a field, hard fought, dearly won, barely held, drenched with blood, upon tokens presaging evil for the Union Army. So they certainly knew more fighting lay ahead. They had no idea of the eventual outcome. They knew the next day, July 3rd, might decide the fate of the Union. And once again, they were right. Once again, this hill on July 3rd would play a vital role on the third and final day of the fighting. So what we want to do now is actually cross the Baltimore Pike. We'll walk right through the National Cemetery, and we'll see how Cemetery Hill would play that vital role on the last day of the battle. Okay. What we're going to do... We're out with some guy who talked real fast. It was freezing. Oh, it was so cold. I don't even know what he said, but boy, it was so cold. That's what you're going to. I know it already. Are those some of our groups still coming?
I think so.
Wow, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Let's talk to each other, Susan. Laws work for masses of Union infantry and artillery. And even though it's not as steep, it's still a very formidable position because of the openness of it. And that's what I'm going to talk about in a second. It's all changed. And if you stood here in 1863 and looked out, you would see nothing but fields stretching across in front of you. And that's why it's so difficult, because they were going under fire the whole way. Okay. Do I get everybody? Okay, let's go. All right, now, of course, everybody knows today the third day of Gettysburg is marked as being most famous because of what became known as Pickett's Charge. Or if you want to be politically correct today, it's now called the Pickett-Pettigrew-Trimble Charge. Our Longstreet's Assault. Whatever it's called, it certainly marks the high watermark of the Confederacy. Basically, when you talk about Pickett's Charge today, all you do is go down to the high watermark area, the clump of trees and the stone wall and the angle, and that's where you talk about it. Although, really, that's where the Confederate attack penetrated the Union line. I think Pickett's Charge, you have to remember, really encompassed most of the Union battle line. Almost all of it, and especially including this area we're standing on right now. As stated before, Cemetery Hill was an excellent artillery platform. That's not just on the other side of the hill where we were earlier, East Cemetery Hill, but it's also true for where you're standing right now. Again, all these trees have grown up. These are the ones that were planted as part of the landscaping plan to the cemetery. Not only the trees growing up and matured, but all this development I talked about, including the Park Service Visitor Center, is right across from us, blocks your field of view, blocks the view shed. You don't get nearly the sense of how open the area was. However, to the artillerymen that were here, it was obvious. Now, all these batteries you see, these monuments placed in the cemetery marking the Union artillery, would be the guns under the command of Major Thomas Osborne. Osborne commanded the 11th Corps Artillery. And he noted his batteries were, quote, faced to the west. That's west. Commanding the plain and the low fields beyond, we commanded the plain perfectly with no timber intervening over which any of the enemy's infantry must advance to make a charge towards this area. So all of this would have been completely open. If you look out across this area, we can lower our umbrellas for a second, you'll see beyond the field, the parking lot in the field, you'll see some flags sticking up. That's near the Kentucky Fried Chicken. Okay, beyond the Kentucky Fried Chicken is an open field. That's the field of Pickett's Charge. All of that would have been open. The visitor center and these trees blocked today that field also. Take all that away and all those trees along Steinway Avenue, it would have been a much better field to fire. That's what these men were seeing. Altogether, Osborne had under his command 8 full or partial batteries totaling 36 guns, facing generally to the west, although some were facing to the northwest. And these are the guns that would be vital on July 3rd. Now, these guns sitting up here in the open with this great field of fire are also obvious to the Confederates, who are now planning on launching what would be known as Pickett's Charge. What Lee wanted to do was finish off the Union Army. General Lee, still confident that his army could succeed here at Gettysburg, and confident with the partial successes he had made on July 2nd against the ends of the Union line, determined today to make a crushing assault against the Union Army. He would take 3 divisions of his infantry. He thought he had 15,000 men, and he would also gather about 150 of his own guns for a massive bombardment. This bombardment would concentrate along the whole Union line, specifically along the center of the Union line where the attack would be directed. Once the bombardment had destroyed the Union artillery, demoralized the Union infantry, he'd launch 3 divisions across these fields I just pointed out, smash into the center of the Union line and cut the Union army in two. That was his plan. But in order to make the plan succeed, of course, the bombardment had to work. Now, this bombardment I mentioned, 150 guns, would be the largest single cannonade ever ordered by an American officer up until that time in American history. And they're going to try to place their, they're going to start placing their guns along Seminary Ridge out here in preparation for this bombardment. And for placing their guns, obviously the 8 batteries on this hill were an obvious target. They must knock these guns down. And those preparations, those Confederate preparations out there, that distant ridge line is Seminary Ridge, were obvious to the Union forces. One man, one Union soldier, later talked about this. I believe it was Osborne, as a matter of fact. I can get to the quote, I'll talk about it. Here we go again. All right, this is what Osborne wrote. We are in plain view of the batteries of the enemy on at least a mile and a half of his line. The slope of the hill in our rear, he's talking about the rear Cemetery Hill, was too steep to use as cover for the guns or even the caissons. The distance of the enemy guns for us was from 3/4 of a mile to a mile and a half. An excellent range. The country all open, no woods intervening between our line and between the enemy's batteries on Cemetery Hill. We made the best target for artillery practice the enemy had during the war. So they knew the Confederates were preparing for something. The Union commanders also were aware they faced a huge disadvantage in this position. Although they had excellent artillery platforms, the Confederate battle line was longer. And since it wrapped around the Union line, what that meant was, in making this bombardment, the Confederates could converge their fire upon one point. There were massive guns all around this area, from the north, the northwest, and the west, all into one point. With all the Union batteries firing out, and they had to disperse their fire. So their fire wouldn't be as effective. Although most of the Confederate artillery, as I said, would be concentrated in the high watermark area, over 50 Confederate guns were assigned to silence these 36 guns on this hill during the bombardment. Now, Osborne prepared his men as best he could. They began to wait then. They began to settle down and wait. And that wait, of course, ended about 1 o'clock in the afternoon when the bombardment began. General Howard, commanding the 11th Corps, on this hill described the beginning of the cannonade. So the signal gun was fired by the enemy, and from the southwest, the west, the north, and the northeast, his batteries opened, hurling into the cemetery grounds missiles of every description. Shells burst in the air, on the ground, at our right and left, in the front, killing men and horses, exploding caissons, overturning tombstones, and smashing fences. In the Evergreen Cemetery, the town cemetery is just behind you, behind this iron fence. That's the tombstones he's talking about. Colonel James Biddle also remembered this cannonade. He said this artillery duel, which lasted over an hour and a half, was the most severe of any experience anywhere during the war. The air was filled with bursting shell and solid shot, and the very earth shook from the resounding cannons. Osborne, right in the middle of it, with his 8 batteries, recalled what happened. "Nothing," he wrote, "which can be written will convey to the non-military man the slightest idea of the fire concentrated on the cemetery hill during the hour and a half it continued. The shells must have reached us at a rate of 100 and upwards every minute, at the least. The officers and men were killed and wounded rapidly, a caisson blown up every minute, and every few minutes, and now and then an artillery carriage was struck and knocked to pieces." Now, the Union High Command, during this bombardment, still realized the importance of Cemetery Hill and were very concerned. Osborne himself related an incident that occurred during this cannonade. He said, "While the fire was at its greatest severity, General Meade, accompanied by a staff officer, came upon the hill and asked me if we could stay. We could actually stay and hold this ground. I assured him we would do so. He said the result of the fight depended upon our holding this hill." So Meade realized how important it was. Then Osborne also later wrote, "The men showed no signs of demoralization. In its official report, he even stated, our artillery endured this fire with coolness and determination. None of our batteries even showed a disposition to retire. Our guns worked with their greatest coolness, energy, and judgment." Of course, the cannonade lasted for over 2 hours, or nearly 2 hours anyway. A massive bombardment. And finally, the Union artillery slackened, the Confederate artillery slackened, and then one had said, a singularly depressing quiet covered the entire field. Shortly after that quiet began, of course, then, the Confederate attack would begin. I think we needed this anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not random. It's not random. Thanks a lot. It's too much. That's good. Okay. I feel warm already. Don't you? Right. At that point, then, the Confederate infantry began to appear along Seminary Ridge. 3 divisions of Confederate troops. You really can't see any of it today with all these trees and everything, but it basically would have stretched almost opposite, or not quite opposite where we're standing, a little bit off to your right, and the down long Seminary Ridge, all the way past those flags, about another half a mile beyond that. Almost all the Confederate line, 2 to 6 ranks deep, 12 to 13,000 men, would have been visible to the men on this hill. An impressive sight it was. This is what Osborne said. In just a few minutes, the infantry of the enemy broke over the cover of the crest of Cemetery Ridge. General Howard remembered this Confederate advance as an extensive parade. The flags were flying and the line steadily advancing. At this point also, the advantage of this hill was obvious, and Osborne stated, the enemy's lines of battle were now in plain view, no trees or other obstructions intervening. More batteries were quickly called up from the artillery reserve and placed on this hill, and during the advance of the Confederate forces, over 30 Union guns began to fire on the men of Pickett's charge, and they were quick to take advantage of it. One man said, so soon as the enemy's first line of battle had fully developed over the ridge, this is what Osborne wrote, I ordered all the batteries to open upon it. This is how he described the fire from this hill upon Pickett's charge. We hear about the fire from the Round Top, from other areas farther down the Union line, but the fire from this hill, which has been ignored, was very effective. Osborne said, every solid shot which struck either line cut out 2 men. But when a shell exploded immediately in front of either line, it cut out 4, 6, 8, or even more men, making a wide gap in their line. These gaps, and the width of them, could be as distinctly seen from this hill as if we'd been very close to them. And once they had the range, they just poured on the fire, as the Confederates steadily advanced across this field. Most of the fire of the from this hill was concentrated upon the left flank of the assaulting column. The right flank, again, was mostly out of view once the attack began. Osborne remembered, the whole force of artillery was brought to bear upon this column, and the havoc produced upon their ranks was truly surprising. One of the Confederate units they really battered badly was a Virginia brigade of Virginia soldiers commanded by General Brockenbrough. Badly battered on the first day, now even more battered on the third day, Brockenbrough's men actually broke and began to retreat, reaching the Emmitsburg Road, which is Steinway Avenue today. Once the Confederates got to Steinway Avenue, the Emmitsburg Road, began to climb over the fences, then of course they began to advance. What happens is they began to move out of view. You can't see it today because the visitor center are away, but just beyond Cemetery Hill, there's a rise of ground which begins Cemetery Ridge and Ziegler's Grove, where the Cyclorama Center is today. All of that would have blocked then the advancing Confederate columns. These guns fell silent. The Confederate advance continued right into the teeth of the Union defenses at the high watermark area. And as we know today, shortly after the Pickett Pettigrew Trimble charge was repulsed, and the Confederates began to stream back across this field. It was repulsed, however, I think, in large part because of the 30-some-odd guns on top of this hill. Osborne, in his official report, stated, "I am convinced the fire from the hill was one of the main auxiliaries in breaking the force of this grand charge." In 3 days of fighting, then, tremendous bloodshed and letting here at Gettysburg, the Union Army had won a great victory here, the turning point of the war, some call it. I personally believe that victory was won in large part because of Cemetery Hill. One, it was a rallying point for the Union forces on July 1st, and a determining factor in choosing the battlefield. Two, when the Union Army formed a new line, it became the apex for that fishhook defense line, protecting the Baltimore Pike. It was an ideal artillery platform, and it was really the keystone for the entire Union line. And thirdly, during the fighting on July 2nd and 3rd, as we've seen, Cemetery Hill greatly influenced the action, repulsing the Confederate attack on July 2nd, and also inflicting severe damage on Pickett's charge on July 3rd. I think 11th Corps Divisional Commander Brigadier General Adolf von Steinwehr probably best summed all of this up in his official report when he wrote, "Cemetery Hill is the commanding point of the whole position. Its occupation by our forces had a decisive influence on the further progress and final result of the battle. The battle had been won. Temporarily, the Union was saved, but at a very, very great cost. 51,000 casualties in 3 days, the bloodiest battle of the entire war. The countryside around us, as you can imagine, was devastated. People's lives have been shattered, not only the soldiers, but the civilians as well. And of course, the next big step for the people left behind is the recovery, the rebuilding process. And in that rebuilding process, Cemetery Hill also played a vital role. And that's the next thing I want to talk about. During the rebuilding process, we've seen about how the hill influenced the battle. Now we're going to talk about how the hill would influence the recovery process and being chosen for the site of a sacred burial ground, the National Cemetery, which you're standing in right now. Let's walk closer to the center of the cemetery and we'll talk about the next phase of the hill during its history. Thank you. Oh, yeah. All righty. Well, next we're going to talk about how the hill influenced the recovery process. And, of course, that leads into the site that's being chosen as the site of the Soldiers' National Cemetery. Now, this isn't battle-related, but I think what happens here is also very important, so I wanted to take some moments to discuss this, get an idea how the hill is so important in not only the battle, but the subsequent history of the park. Now, the immediate concerns of the recovery effort, the aftermath of the battle, are actually the 7,000 dead, then the 3,000 wounded who died of the wounds afterwards. So that's 10,000 dead and 30,000 wounded. Obviously, for an area that only, a county, Adams County at that time, number 28,000 people, you got 30,000 wounded left behind, you're doubling the population of the county, wounded and alone. You could see how overwhelming this recovery effort was. Endless obstacles, it seemed. And many solutions in the recovery effort were short-term solutions, like the dead. You're taking the dead, men who have fallen in these fields, and burying them right where they'd fallen. Shallow graves, most dug not more than a foot and a half deep, very crude burials. Just keep them underground. Remember, hot, humid, sunny, sultry. To be gross, these bodies are rotting in the summer sun. There's a great fear of an epidemic. So they wanted to get them underground. That's why the battlefield graves are so crude. The wounded were crowded into field hospitals across the county and farms, barnyards, and so on. Now, this is the situation that Governor Andrew Curtin would see when he visited the area 1 week after the battle. Very concerned about what he'd seen, the suffering of the local community, and especially the wounded, too. Curtin had volunteers from across the country rush in with medical supplies and so on to help out. But Curtin was also very concerned about the graves he saw out here. 1 week later, with heavy rains, just like today, the graves had been washed back up again. In some cases, hogs were rooting through the bodies and eating them. And he didn't think it was right, Curtin, didn't think it was right that these northern men who had lost their lives had not received a proper burial, especially the Pennsylvania dead. So Curtin contacted a prominent Republican lawyer in town named David Wills to be his state representative. Take care of the Pennsylvania dead and wounded soldiers. That was his job. Be his state agent. So David Wills went right out and started to do his job. Events then rapidly transpired, however, to force a change in plans. Because what Wills and Curtin originally wanted to do was take the dead Pennsylvania soldiers, locate their graves, box them, and ship them home. The state would actually pay for the removal of the bodies to ship back to family cemeteries. That's not going to happen because the graves were deteriorating too rapidly. The crude identification for being lost. So what Wills decided to do, David Wills, the state agent, was to call a meeting with all the other northern state agents and the other northern state governors. And that way they could pool their resources and decide what to do with all the northern dead. And out of this meeting came the idea of what is today known as the Soldiers National Cemetery. They thought maybe they should ship the bodies home, or maybe locate the graves in a local cemetery like the Evergreen Cemetery over here. But they finally decided the best thing to do would be buy some land and make it into a soldier cemetery just for the Union dead.
How are those graves marked?
The battlefield graves?
Yeah, they got a shallow
fence
grave.
Posts,
boards. How did they know who was there?
Well, these fence posts and boards would have names scrawled on them. Varied by the soldiers, they tried to mark the graves as best they could. So they're going to establish a separate cemetery just for the northern dead. So you're going to be created and financed by the states. So now Wills is going to head up this project. He's in charge of making financial arrangements, the reburial methods and expenses, the basic blueprint for the cemetery, and most importantly, what Wills has to decide to do is where to locate the cemetery. He's got to buy the land. In a July 24th letter, I'm sure it was hot that day, July 24th, Wills wrote to Governor Curtin, and he described how he envisioned, what he envisioned is the best location for this cemetery. This is what he wrote. There is one spot very desirable for this purpose. It's an elevated piece of ground on the Baltimore Turnpike opposite the Evergreen Cemetery. It is the place where our army had about 40 pieces of artillery in action all Thursday and Friday, and for their protection had thrown up large numbers of earthworks for the artillerists. As at this point was the desperate attack was made by the Louisiana Brigades on Thursday evening, and they succeeded in reaching the guns, taking possession of them, and finally were driven back by the infantry, assisted by the artillerymen with their handspikes and rammers. It was the key to the whole line of our defenses, the apex of the triangular line of battle. It is the spot above all others, the honorable burial of the dead would fall on these fields. Obviously, what Wills is talking about is not the ground we're standing on now. He's talking about the ground at East Cemetery Hill when we were earlier. Ricketts Battery wise, that's where he wanted to locate the cemetery. Even though it's not here, it's still in Cemetery Hill. So once again, Cemetery Hill is the focal point of attention. It seemed natural to Wills to locate this grave site on the key terrain feature on the battlefield. That's what they saw Cemetery Hill as just after the battle. This was the key to the Union position. This is the most important position. He's talking about 8 acres of ground on East Cemetery Hill. Well, surprisingly enough, Wills wasn't the only one who had the same idea. David McConaghy is another prominent Republican lawyer in town. He's also the chairman of the Evergreen Cemetery. And unknown to Wills, at that very same time, McConaghy had purchased that land Wills had just written about. He had purchased that land to expand the Evergreen Cemetery to do the same thing. He wants to create a section of his cemetery just for the Union dead. He's already buried over 100 Union soldiers in the Evergreen Cemetery. They still lie there today. Union soldiers have never got in this cemetery because they were buried by Wills in the Evergreen Cemetery. So they're working against each other for the same idea, though. Both had the same idea, and both saw Cemetery Hill as a natural place to put the cemetery. Now, Wills found out what McConaghy was doing, and of course he was rather upset, as you can imagine. Here, Wills is supposed to have this national cemetery project, and he finds out that McConaghy is undercutting him, and he's trying to make his project not a national project, but more of a local project. So, even though they're both Republicans, they didn't like each other, and Wills called McConaghy a speculator. He thought that McConaghy had overstepped his boundary, overstepped his authority, and undercut him. And more importantly, he got a head start on the cemetery project. So if McConaughey got his way, it would change the whole nature of the cemetery. They said it would be a more local, not a national cemetery. However, even though Wills didn't like McConaughey, I don't think McConaughey was all bad, because besides his plans for the cemetery project I talked about to bury the Union dead, he's also started another project at that same time. And this project included purchasing land, not only the land. The thought occurred to me there could be no more fitting and expressive memorial for the heroic valor and signal triumph of our army on the first, second, and third days of July, 1863, the battlefield itself, with its natural and artificial defenses preserved and perpetuated in the exact form and condition that they were presented during the battle. Just within 2 months after the battle, hold it, skipped ahead, what I did there. What he's trying to do is unheard of at the time. He's trying to preserve the battlefield itself as a memorial. It's never been done before. When you want to put up a memorialize a battlefield before that time, you put up a monument, like a Revolutionary War battlefield. Here, McConaughey's trying to buy the land as a memorial, which is revolutionary. Well, he'd done this all within 3 weeks of the battle, and he bought the land at his own expense. What this would lead to is the establishment of what is called the Gettysburg Battlefield Memorial Association, and eventually at least the establishment of Gettysburg National Military Park as we know it today. And once again, Cemetery Hill is the forefront of this visionary effort, because the first land that McConaughey bought for this innovative movement was the land on East Cemetery Hill. He sees it as the most important position on the battlefield. So hindsight today tells us how incredible McConaughey's actions were. At the time it was taking place, it was nothing but a hindrance to David Wills. Because David Wills was trying to establish the Soldiers' National Cemetery. And they hate each other, Wills and McConaughey did. But after 3 weeks of backbiting and behind-the-doors dealing and so on, what finally happens is lots of frustration, but negotiations are worked out that allows David Wills to buy 17 acres of land where we're standing right now on Cemetery Hill to establish the National Cemetery. McConaughey gives up his plan to bury the Union dead in the Evergreen Cemetery, but Wills is supposed to ship the cemetery here. But even still, it's on Cemetery Hill. And once the cemetery is purchased then, the project was underway. And despite the amount of difficulties, the project had already taken on a higher meaning to all the men involved. David Wills had already called it many times up to this point a sacred project, noble work, a sacred purpose. The Evergreen Cemetery Board, led by David McConaughey, called this whole thing a noble enterprise, a grand national enterprise. Thus, in turn, the perception of this ground we're standing on also changes. It took on a higher significance. Andrew Curtin, the governor, said these were sacred grounds. So then just 2 months after this battle, the meaning of the hill, which was so pivotal during the battle itself, has also changed. It's grown tremendously. Plans for the cemetery were finalized by David Wills during the fall of 63. He hired a landscape architect, William Saunders, one of the best of that time period, was hired to lay out the cemetery grounds. The surveying was completed, the contracts for reburial were awarded. Well, that's going to be delayed because of all the hot weather. Arrangements for the reburials were determined. And then, when they did that, they decided they would bury the dead by stake. Now, originally, what David Wills wanted to do was take all the northern dead and bury them side by side in the cemetery, regardless of the state they were from. He thought they'd fallen for one cause, they should go side by side together, equal. But the states wouldn't hear of that. The states were giving the money to establish the cemetery. They wanted the individuals buried by separate states. And that's each plot of land, then, would be determined by how many men each state lost. And even here, the plan was chosen to represent a central message of the whole cemetery idea, and that idea was equality. These all men died as equals, they fought for equality, and here again, Cemetery Hill and its terrain is going to create a problem. They're trying to lay out the graves. William Saunders, the landscape architect, described this. This is what he wrote. The surface of the grounds were somewhat undulating, falling away. Some high, others low and inferior in comparison, so that in distributing the interments by the state, some would, of necessity, be placed in a lower proportion. And thus, apparently, unjust discrimination might be inferred. So William Saunders is very concerned if he put one state lower than another on the hill, some states would get upset. So laying out the blueprint for the cemetery, the hill actually determined how he would do it, which once again stressed this idea of equality. He decided instead of laying out the graves in a square pattern, he laid them out in a semicircle. You're right in the middle of that semicircle now. You see other graves in a semicircle here, and that gives each state equal proportion by the minute lost, and thus on the highest point would be put a central monument. And thus no state would get the highest point on the hill. This is how Saunders described it. Thus the position of each lot and indeed of each interment was relatively of equal importance. So it stretches that equality theme. And the hill and the terrain of Cemetery Hill determined how that would be laid out. Final outcome, the meeting of the cemetery. Also stressing the equality theme was the fact that when they buried them in by states, if you walk along, you'll see that officers and enlisted men are buried side by side. That's a very uncommon practice in the 19th century. The reburials were actually begun on October 26th,
the arrival of cooler weather, just like today. It is cool. At the same time, at that point then, the wheels in the committee began to turn their attention to actually consecrating grounds, dedicating the grounds. Now, in the dedication ceremony, of course, will be November 19th, 1863. And in planning the ceremony, you have to keep in mind that the entire project was not a federal project, it was a state project. So it's not surprising when the first invitations went out, they went out to state representatives, people like senators, congressmen, governors, and military leaders. They also decided the principal speaker that day would not be President Lincoln, but another man, Edward Everett of Massachusetts, one of the greatest speakers of that time period. President of Harvard College, governor of Massachusetts, senator, secretary of state, so on. Very famous man. All this time, no federal representatives had really been invited yet, which again stresses the whole role of the state project, being a state project. Now, as we do know, Lincoln would be invited. Abraham Lincoln would eventually be invited to the cemetery dedication near the end of October, when all the other federal representatives were also invited at the same time. When the official invitation was actually sent later, November 2nd, and in that official invitation, which David Wills wrote to Abraham Lincoln, this is what Wills wrote. It is the desire that after the oration, you, as chief executive of the nation, formally set aside or apart these grounds for their sacred purpose and use by a few appropriate remarks. And this, of course, leads us to our last big event that occurs on this hill, which helps to define this hill, why it's so important. This is that nationally defining moment I talked about, the deliverance of the Gettysburg Address. Now, we know today that site is not the correct site. The general history tells us where the Soldiers' National Monument stands today is where Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. Well, we're not positive that's where it was delivered. It was somewhere close by, and there's different theories as to where. The most important thing you have to remember in my talk, however, is the fact that it was delivered on this hill, making this site even more sacred and more important. The Gettysburg Address certainly is one of the most famous speeches in American, if not world, history. And for me to try to describe its meaning to you while you're sitting here, standing here freezing for about 5 minutes is ludicrous.
Thank you,
the whole cemetery, the whole seminars have been dedicated to the Gettysburg Address. Whole books have been written about it. So I'm not going to try to pretend to tell you what the Gettysburg Address meant or means to people today. Worldwide, it's a very famous speech. I do want to, however, stress one important point. I think that when Lincoln came here and delivered his speech at Gettysburg on November 19, 1863, it was a nationally defining moment. He knew, or let's put it this way, Lincoln perceived the war to be a test of democracy. He was attempting, I think, to change what the nation stood for and what it represented. You could say, simply put it this way. Lincoln was trying to change the meaning of the nation. It was as defined by the Constitution of the United States, whose main purpose was to define a system of government into a nation defined by the country's founding document. And that document being the Declaration of Independence, which spells out what the nation stood for. He did that in his speech, which lasted less than 2 minutes. He actually did it in the very first sentence. 77 years ago, he was attacked. 76 years from 1863, you get 1776, not 1787 when the Constitution was written. 77 years ago, our fathers brought forth in this continent, he said, a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated the proposition that all men are created equal. That comes directly out of the Declaration of Independence. And that defines the nation as we know it today, because the Gettysburg Address is so important in our conscience and how we are taught in school as to what this nation stands for. I think it redefined our nation. Now, the multiple meanings of the Gettysburg Address also give the site, Cemetery Hill, a more importance and a more sacred meaning. Though the cemetery was dedicated, the cemetery was not complete until later in 1864. March of 1864, all the burials were completed, 3,512 actually being buried within these grounds. However, even though the men were buried, the cemetery wasn't completed. Other work continued. The headstones you see here went in about 2 years later. The landscaping was completed in 1864. And amazingly enough, some of the men who completed this work were actually the veterans who fought here. A newspaper, the Gettysburg Sentinel at that time, later described this. The grounds are beginning to present a most handsome appearance. This is in 1865, 2 years after the dedication. Handsome appearance, it said, in the course of a few years will be unsurpassed in beauty by any other spot in the world. This great work has given employment to a great number of laborers, among whom we are pleased to notice a large number of returned soldiers. Probably some fought upon the very ground which they are now helping to beautify. So
I think it points out that within 2 years, the ground that we're standing on, which had been so significant during the battle, was now also very significant for the brave men who fought here. That perception also displayed by the nation as a whole. And as an example, 1868, 3 years after the end of the war, 5 years after this battle was over, a tradition of holding special Memorial Day ceremonies in this cemetery was started. It was called Decoration Day. It continues 128 years ago today. That's not right. You can figure it out. By the late 1870s, speakers of national prominence were speaking here at this cemetery on Memorial Day, including 4 presidents and 2 vice presidents from that brick rostrum you see right down over here. And these same ceremonies continue 128 years later, every Memorial Day. In 1869, the dedication of the Soldiers' National Monument took place. And at that point, this ceremony, first of all, marked a national trend towards reconciliation, and then it also began to mark how Cemetery Hill became a national platform. Because during that dedication of that monument, 1869, General George Gordon Meade, the victor, the man who won the Battle of Gettysburg, came here and delivered a few even shorter remarks than what Lincoln had said 2 years before. Thank you. This is what he wrote. This is what Meade wrote, which I think is very important to understand when you talk about the meaning of this hill and how the nation is changing from the events that occur on this hill. This is what he wrote. Meade said, "When I contemplate this field, I see here and there the marks of hastily dug trenches in which reposed the dead against whom we fought. Above them, a bit of plank indicates simply these are the remains of the fallen were hurriedly laid there by soldiers who met them in battle. Why should we not collect them in some suitable place? In all civilized countries, it is the usage to bury the dead with the decency and respect, and even the fallen enemies, respectful burial is recorded in death. I earnestly hope this suggestion may have some influence throughout our broad land, for this is not the only, this is one of only of 100 crowded battlefields. Meade was saying, let's bury the Confederate dead still in their shallow graves in this cemetery and in other places on other battlefields. National reconciliation. It's a national platform. And that continues today, almost 133 years later. The cemetery actually became officially national in 1872 when it was transferred to U.S. Government control. And once again, the hill, which was involved as a major event in the ever-shaping battlefield, continued to reflect our changing history. The first reunions that were held by the soldiers in the 1880s when they came back to put up their monuments were held on East Cemetery Hill, with ceremonies and encampments. The first monument placed on this battlefield, like the Minnesota flower urn over here, right there, placed in this hill, in the cemetery on this hill. It also took on a more physical role as various other wars continued, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II. So many graves were being created here, men being buried here, veterans, that in 1948 an annex was added over here, bringing the total acreage of the cemetery up to 21 acres. And also Korea and Vietnam veterans are buried in the cemetery today. Over 7,000 graves are within the boundaries today. So it reflects, I think, a large part of our nation's military history and national character in this ground. 133 years later, Cemetery Hill has retained not only its original significance, but I think also taken on a higher meaning. Every November 19th, speakers come here. I was going to give you a few examples, but we're too cold. But basically, these speakers come here and use this as a scene of a national platform and national rededication. We've had people like Jack Kemp, now running for vice president. We've had Colin Powell speak here. This November 19th, we're going to have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor speak here. And if you read their speeches, you can still see how they're using this ground as a site to try to define the nation, just like Lincoln did 133 years ago. I think Gettysburg and Cemetery Hill also has and will continue to be a focal point of national definition and redefinition as long as we have these speeches here every November 19th. Okay, let's wrap this up before we freeze to death. Basically, hopefully what I've proved to you in the last hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever we've been out here, is that Cemetery Hill is, I think, one of the most sacred areas of the entire Gettysburg battlefield, thus making it one of the most sacred of the entire nation. It was a vital terrain feature which influenced the battle and the final outcome of the fight. It was a sacred burial ground created to honor the sacrifice of American servicemen and women throughout our nation's history, and is also the site of a nationally defining moment, the Gettysburg Address. To understand
I think it's easy to understand then how quickly this hallowed ground took on a huge significance to our nation's conscience. That fact was made clear when the first history of the Soldiers' National Cemetery was written in 1865, 3 years after the end of the battle and just months after the end of the war. Within that short time span, this hill and the cemetery contained upon it had already gained a respect as an honored and sacred place. For in part, this history reads, "Such was the origin and final resting place for the remains of our departed heroes who nobly laid down their lives as sacrifice on their nation's altar. The place where they now lie will be honored, protected, and preserved." Truly then, just as that same history stated, Cemetery Hill is, quote, "a field made glorious." Thanks for sticking with me.
Yeah, thank you. Oh.